You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Maria McKinley.
And I'm Doug Storm. This is the Daily Local News for Monday, June 27th, 2016.
And it was just story after story of a black student at this campus giving an example of how they don't feel safe and often backing that up with an actual story of something that had happened to them.
Struggles for racial justice at Indiana University and beyond. Later in the show, in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we hear about the desperate need for pro bono attorneys. That's on Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community. But first, these local headlines.
The Supreme Court issued a decision today that may change the landscape of abortion law in Indiana. By a 5-3 margin, the court struck down laws in Texas that imposed tougher standards on abortion clinics and would have forced many to close. The court focused on two specific parts of the law. The first required doctors at abortion clinics to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, and the second would have required clinics to spend millions of dollars upgrading their facilities to the same standards as outpatient surgical centers. The majority opinion, written by Justice Stephen Breyer, ruled that the requirements were medically unnecessary and placed an undue burden on the ability to access abortion services. The court did not believe Texas's argument that the law was necessary to protect women from harm during abortion procedures. The ruling drew heavily from Planned Parenthood v. Casey, a 1992 case which established the undue burden standard as a matter of legal precedent.
The court found that both of these requirements did not further any state interest in protecting the life and health of the mother, and instead acted as an impediment to the right to obtain an abortion, and therefore they were deemed to be unconstitutional.
That was Ken Falk, legal director for the Indiana ACLU. They are currently involved in a lawsuit challenging House Bill 1337, a package of new abortion restrictions signed into law earlier this year. The Indiana law, while conceptually similar to the Texas bill, has several differences. Indiana is attempting to add new requirements concerning the disposal of fetal tissue, as well as requiring abortion seekers to obtain an ultrasound and receive state-designed brochures. The state argues these information campaigns are important for informed consent. One crucial similarity is that H.R. 1337 also requires doctors at abortion clinics to have admitting privileges, the very same requirement just struck down in Texas.
Well, there are not identical provisions on the books in Indiana, but what the Texas case tells us is that if restrictions are imposed, and specifically imposed on abortion clinics and not other clinics, then they have to be examined very closely to determine if they really are designed to protect the life and health of the mother, or if they are instead designed to throw up roadblocks on the right to obtain an abortion. And Indiana, like many states, have attempted to impose new and more onerous regulations, and obviously all that now has to be filtered through the lens of this new case.
The Indiana ACLU is not challenging H.R. 1337 on the undue burden standard, as was the case in Texas. Instead, they are arguing that the law doesn't even meet the basic rational basis standard. That precedent says that, at a bare minimum, the government must show a rational reason for passing laws that may infringe on constitutional rights. In short, the ACLU says the law just doesn't make any sense.
Well, we obviously challenged those. We did not challenge on the grounds they were an undue burden. We challenged on the grounds that they were not rational. One of the things that the case today focused on is what is the state's rationale, what is the justification for any restriction, and you know, we argue there really is no justification for the restrictions currently in the law concerning disposal of fetal and embryonic tissue.
The Indiana law is scheduled to take effect July 1st, but the ACLU is expecting a district court decision on whether to issue an injunction blocking the law before then. From there, the Supreme Court's ruling is likely to be invoked when the district courts begin hearing arguments. The ruling fell along traditional party lines in the court, with Justices Roberts, Alito, and Thomas opposing the liberal-leaning majority.
The Monroe County Prosecutor's Office released a statement today expressing its frustrations over a case involving a former IU student and two separate accusations of rape. The former student, John Enoch, spent one day in jail and will serve 1 year of probation after pleading guilty to battery with moderate injury as part of a plea deal. Both of the rape charges against him were dismissed by the prosecutors due to, quote, evidentiary problems, unquote. The most recent incident was in April 2015. According to court documents obtained by Fox 59, a woman claimed she had been raped at the fraternity house Delta Tau Delta, but didn't know the alleged attacker. Security footage showed her entering a private room with Enoch and leaving alone 24 minutes later. Health officials said she had suffered a laceration to her genitals. While this case was under investigation, a second incident from 2013 resurfaced. The woman from that case agreed to assist the police, and DNA evidence and witness statements again led police to Enoch. According to the statement released by the prosecutor's office, the initial decision to charge Enoch was based heavily on the fact that there were two complaints against the same defendant, made years apart from one another. The statement explains that both cases had to be presented separately, and law dictates that a jury for one case wasn't allowed to know about the other rape charge. This made it difficult for the prosecutors to pursue either of the accusations, as the investigations revealed that, quote, neither case, standing alone, presented sufficient evidence to prove rape, unquote. The prosecutor's office stated the 2013 charge was dropped because the complaining witness could not remember much of the alleged rape and the witnesses to it, quote, could not recall important events due to the passage of time and the consumption of alcohol, unquote. Photographs were also discovered that went against the complaining witness's statements. In the more recent case, the DNA evidence was dismissed because it was, quote, problematic, unquote, and prevented any attempts to prove that Enoch was the cause of the witness's injury. According to the statement, video evidence also emerged that did not support the complaining witness's assertions of forcible rape. Because of the conflicting and insufficient evidence for either case, the prosecutors dropped the charges against Enoch and instead pursued a plea deal. The statement from the prosecutor's office says Enoch originally entered a plea of guilty to battery as a level 6 felony, and the decision to enter it as a misdemeanor was, quote, within the court's discretion, unquote. Bloomington lawyer Catherine Lyle, who defended Enoch in court, called the charges against him, quote, sensationalized and false, unquote. In her statement, she says her client should never have been charged with the rape cases as he did not commit the crimes.
The Monroe County Commissioners approved a $234,000 contract for new financial software in their meeting this morning. According to the contract, South Bend-based Lau Associates will provide new database management software to replace the Harris software currently being used. Monroe County's IT Director Eric Evans said the Harris software was underperforming.
As you know, having clean numbers in the auditor's office is incredibly important. We feel that our previous vendor has not been very helpful in helping us get the kind of performance we need out of our current package. So I think at this point, we're pretty much all in agreement that it's time to move on to a different solution.
Evans said much due diligence went into researching the software, including contacting other county administrators who use Lau Associates' product. He said they feel the Lau system will improve efficiency and allow for better reporting. Deputy Auditor Therese Chambers said her initial experience with Lau Associates has been positive.
I'd like to say that our working relationship with Lau for the property tax system has made settlement much more efficient. And we finished this year about a week and a half and got final approval from the state about a week and a half early. So the units got their money earlier.
The conversion to the new system will begin with 2014 records. Andy Lau of Lau Associates assured commissioners that staff will receive primarily one-on-one training over the course of a year. County Attorney Jeff Cockrell said the project would ultimately be paid for with bond monies. In other business, commissioners approved a new internal control policy for county government in an effort to promote accountability. The internal control policy will provide a framework for assessing and managing financial risk and provide rules for effective operations, including monitoring and reporting. Commissioners Administrator Angela Purdy said state statute requires all counties and cities to have an internal control policy in place by June 30th in order to be in compliance with the State Board of Accounts. Purdy said that under the new policy, individual departments will fine-tune their own specific procedures, which will then be reviewed and approved by committee.
Monroe County Code Chapter 295 is going to recognize the internal control policy. It establishes an oversight committee that will be comprised of two members appointed by the Board of Commissioners, a member appointed by the council, a member by the auditor, and a member by the treasurer. And this group will be reviewing the various departments' policies that they provide, bring forward, and make recommendations to adoption of those particular policies or recommend that they relook at their procedures. And then it also establishes a reporting materiality threshold, and the county has been set at $500. And what this means is that all officials and employees shall immediately report all erroneous or irregular material variances, losses, shortages, misappropriations, or thefts of county property that come to their attention to the commissioners, and the commissioners will immediately forward each report to the State Board of Accounts.
Purdy said departments already have procedures related to internal control, but they had not been codified in this way. Purdy said county employees will receive training in any new procedures and in the future will have to sign off on the new training.
U.S. Senate candidate Todd Young has agreed to participate in two televised debates with Barron Hill, his Democratic challenger for Dan Coats' seat. Hill had challenged Young to four TV debates and five town hall meetings, but so far Young has only agreed to two. Both candidates have previously served as congressional representatives for Indiana's 9th District. The StateHouseFile.com reports the Indiana Debate Commission has not set any dates yet, but typically schedules debates for September or October, just ahead of the election in November. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Maria McKinley.
And I'm Doug Storm. Each Monday during June and July, the Daily Local News is bringing you reports produced through a partnership between WFHB and a community journalism class at Indiana University, taught by Professor Mike Conway. During the spring semester, students volunteered at WFHB and produced final projects about a variety of underreported subjects, from wealth inequality to racial justice. Today's featured story explores a recent outcry from college students across the country who are seeking racial justice and peace on campus. Sit-ins, protests, walkouts, and demonstrations occurred on college campuses throughout the last school year. As Maddie Levin reports, IU is no exception.
From the widely publicized violent attack of a Muslim woman in downtown Bloomington this past October, to the lesser-known assault of IU student Rob Sherrell in downtown Bloomington this past November, IU is facing the same racial tensions that afflict many other collegiate environments. Some on-campus organizations are taking part in the process to increase inclusion on campus for all racial and ethnic groups. Culture of Care is a student-led initiative to promote bystander intervention and the overall well-being of IU's student body, including the well-being and safety for all racial groups on campus.
I think what I learned is that there is A lot of concern, not only from students of color, but also just students in general about the safety issues. And I'm glad that it's being talked about now.
Culture of Care Director of Respect, Atreyi Mukherjee, has spent the school year gauging opinions from students of color on IU's campus to work towards the hopeful future of total racial inclusion and safety.
Since the 80% of the population is white, it is difficult to reach, you know, every section. But I think efforts are being made, and the administration has been supportive, which is good. And I think listening to students from the administration is really important, because it is really student voices that matter.
Mukherjee is an international student herself. Born in India and raised in the Middle East, she felt a personal connection with the topic of race relations on campus. After joining the IU community as a freshman, Mukherjee felt a sense of aversion towards all international students.
So I'll be really honest, my freshman year wasn't the best time for me, and I was kind of thrown into American culture, and it was very difficult for me to adjust, particularly because of like homesickness, but also like there were all these like, so there's this app called Yikyak, I'm sure you've heard of it. I don't have it anymore, but I did freshman year, and there were a lot of like yaks about like international students in particular, about their English, about like the way we dress, and like just really unnecessary rude comments like that, which are just not very conducive to creating an inclusive environment. And I think that's what motivated me to get involved and try to change things instead of just complaining about it.
Mukherjee has worked alongside Culture of Care co-chair Mackenzie Conrad this past school year to work towards the desired inclusive environment. I spoke with Conrad to gauge where he thought race relations stood on IU's campus and how his organization planned to tackle this pertinent issue.
Well, we aren't going to get to a point in racial justice that is good for everyone until we have better numbers of international students, black students, Asian students, Indian students, you know, and just kind of put all of our students in a situation on a campus, in a community in which they can learn from each other and use each other as resources to better understand different cultures.
One of the biggest challenges the Culture of Care team has tried to tackle this year is the international student orientation. The orientation makes no mention of racial injustice or racial discrimination, but there is interest in trying to change that.
I think that people of our generation understand more than ever that we're trying to work together towards a common goal, and the sooner that we can get to a point where everybody feels included and accepted and part of the same community, the sooner we can get past a lot of issues.
IU Associate Sociology Instructor Eric Savelle spoke from a sociologist's perspective on race relations in Bloomington after recently attending a public panel on the topic.
The university has these issues, and the community has these issues, recruiting and encouraging people of color to live here, except when they need them for their sports teams. Magically, they can attract as many people of color as they need in that instance. And so the question becomes, what is the purpose that the university is really using certain people for? And perhaps that has something to do with why black Americans, for instance, other minorities are sort of catching on to that. And they know that to some extent, that that's sort of the environment of this university.
Savelle also made mention of the attack on Rob Sherrill from last semester.
Nobody in the university heard about it. We didn't get the text messages. We didn't get the phone calls. And so this started a really big conversation, and the underlying issue that I think was occurring there is there was a lot of lack of clarity as to how certain issues on campus were prioritized, how people were alerted.
Following the attack of Sherrill, the university held a meeting to discuss the racial violence on campus.
This was at a meeting I went to, and the provost was there, the dean of students was there, and it was a room filled, absolutely filled. I mean, the only time I've ever seen a room where the majority of the people in there were people of color. And it was 90% more. And it was just story after story of a black student at this campus giving an example of how they don't feel safe, and often backing that up with an actual story of something that had happened to them, whether it was a racial slur that was yelled at them, somebody driving by and banging on their truck, things like that.
In Provost Lauren Robel's 2016 State of the Campus address, Robel praised the university for the increased acceptance rate of Black and Latino students into IU's honors programs. However, equality and diversity remain as top priorities and areas of focus by IU's administration. Mukherjee also attended the same meeting with the provost as Savelle.
I went to a meeting with the provost, I think in November, where they were talking about how the concerns of students of color are not really taken into account. And I remember one student in particular talking about how diversity is a very pretty word, but inclusion is what we were really looking for. So, yeah, I think there are definitely tensions, but I think it's getting better because at least the administration has talks about these things. It is really uncomfortable to talk about, so that's a good step in the right direction.
It will take every student's participation to reach these goals set forth by a few, but they are moves to inclusion that are necessary and attainable.
I think still race is a very uncomfortable topic to talk about, and a lot of students who are not people of color are very reluctant to talk about it because they think that it's something accusatory, whereas it really isn't. It's just trying to improve the situation for everyone in general. I hope to see race being talked about more because when people say things are not about race, it really isn't true because a lot of things, historically speaking, and even now, are about race. Like, race does play a role in our lives as people of color, and it is a deterrent to us getting certain things. So I hope that in the future, the students and the administration are able to recognize the specific concerns of people of color, of international students, of these special populations, so that there can be more inclusivity.
For WFHB, this is Maddie Levin.
That story was produced as part of a partnership between WFHB and a community journalism class at Indiana University.
Now it's time for Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community.
Welcome to Activate, featuring tales of inspiration from local citizens who stand up for what they believe in and encouraging you to find your cause, live your passion, make a difference, volunteer.
Hi, I am Sarah Waters with the District 10 Pro Bono Project. District 10 Pro Bono Project is working to serve folks at the lowest socioeconomic level through connecting them with attorneys when otherwise they wouldn't be able to have access to that service. We work with about 9 counties right now. For every one attorney that's willing to do pro bono work, or just attorney in general in the state, there are 8,850 potential clients that desperately need services right now. And so in the face of that, we really are tapping all of our resources, trying to connect that huge number of people to attorneys is the main goal. So we do like an intake process, which means during our intake hours, which we hold 2 days a week, people can call in with whatever issue. Mostly family law issues, a lot of domestic violence. That's our main heart, our main focus. We also do a lot with bankruptcy. So folks can call in, explain the situation, then we'll do a second interview. If we can't take the case, we will try to place them with someone in the community or surrounding communities that can. There are so many volunteer opportunities right now. We would really love to have support with general office task. We really need people to be filing. We really need people to be doing some of the intake. So that would be receiving calls, calling people back. Usually when I do an intake call, at least once a week, I have someone tell me that I have done something for them that they are so grateful for. And that's a weekly, it's just a normal thing because you are so intimately connecting with people in a way that a friend or a mentor or a therapist might not. We also are really needing some volunteers that could be grad students, undergraduates that that know they may want to study law or go into that field, retired folks that have a social service or any other legal background, also anyone with a paralegal background, to do the on-the-ground intake. So that's dealing with the calls that are coming in and really doing like triage work. We also really actually have a lot of fun. It's pretty enjoyable environment to be in. There's stress in terms of the deadlines, but we are all very supportive of one another. Despite the just crazy stress at times, you know at the end of the day that it was something that made someone's life a little easier. Thanks for listening. This is Sarah with the District 10 Pro Bono Project.
You may visit the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network website to see a full organization profile at bloomington.in.gov/volunteer. Now here's a rundown of current volunteer opportunities in Bloomington and Monroe County.
For the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake with three ways to volunteer in the criminal justice and legal fields. District 10 Pro Bono is a nonprofit social service legal aid program serving low-income populations who could not otherwise obtain legal counsel. A part-time volunteer office assistant is needed to help with filing, shredding, data entry, and housekeeping duties for 2 to 8 hours weekly or biweekly. Can you share your skills with this nonprofit? New Leaf, New Life offers services to inmates in the Monroe County Jail during incarceration and after release. Front desk volunteers work 1 2-hour shift a week at their Transition Resource Center, greeting clients, answering phones, and providing resources as needed. And the Community Justice and Mediation Center offers a 40-hour training program for those interested in learning about conflict resolution, mediation, and restorative justice. At the end of this course, participants will be qualified to be a volunteer mediator with CJAM. And that's a look at just some of the ways you can connect to your community through volunteering. For WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake.
You've been listening to Activate, a co-production of WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, working together to build an empowered, vibrant, and engaged community. You may visit bloomington.in.gov/volunteer to find and sign up for local volunteer opportunities. All episodes of Activate are available online at wfhb.org/news/activate. For Bloomington Community Radio, I'm Jennifer Brooks.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Taylor Haggerty and Jared Dill, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, our partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Maddie Levin.
Activate is produced by Jennifer Brooks, along with the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network. Our engineer is Sarah Hetrick. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Doug Storm.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming, online at wfhb.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Bring It On, our local forum on African American people and culture, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.